WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Y. Bell got his start writing jokes for Borscht Belt comics. He went on to write for Saturday Night Live and It's Gary Shandling Show. And he wrote the screenplay for the recent film North, which he adapted from his book of the same name. During his years at Saturday Night Live, he collaborated with Gilda Radner, co-creating some of the characters she became famous for, like Emily Letella and Roseanne Adana. With the exception of a couple of falling outs, they remained close friends until her death from cancer in 1989. So Bell's just written a memoir about their relationship called Bunny Bunny. Here's how they met at Saturday Night Live.
It was the first day. I was 24 years old, and I'm in Lorne Michaels' office, and he has all the writers and the actors for this new show. And I felt so out of place in the midst of all these people that I hid behind a plant, which was in the corner of Lorne Michaels' office. I squatted down behind it, trying to remain as inconspicuous as possible for fear that I would either be called upon or exposed as a fraud of some sort. And I'm down there, and I heard this voice come through the leaves say, can you help me be a parakeet? And I looked up, and it was Gilda. I said, what? She said, yeah, I think it would be really funny if I stood on this perch, a big perch, and sort of squished up my face and squawked. But I need a writer to help me figure out what the parakeet should squawk. Can you help me squawk? And I had no idea what she was talking about, but I was thankful that somebody, in fact, was talking to me. And I said, you bet. And we got to talking, and I realized about halfway through the conversation that she was as scared as I was.
There's a story you tell in your book that has to do with Gilda that I thought was really a scream. There was a party for her at Studio 54, and so she invited your parents to come. And so, you know, there's like, I guess, Mick and Bianca.
well, it was amazing. You
and
know,
your
look,
parents.
She had come to my house one time, and I lived in Long Island, and we took the Long Island Railroad out to my parents' house. And my mom, what she did was, anybody who she thought was famous or was going to be famous, she had them sign the underside of our kitchen chairs. Now, my parents now live in Delray Beach in Florida, okay? And if you should go to their house, and you're more than welcome to, if you turn over their kitchen chairs, you'll see Billy Crystal's name, you'll see Bell's name, you'll see Gilda's name. So we have these famous chairs, you know, in my mom's house. So, you know, Gilda came over for dinner and she signed a chair. And my mom was basically showing her off. You know, we went to a shopping mall to get a cake. And we realized that something was wrong. My mother probably had a different agenda because this mall had no bakery in it. There was clearly no bakery. So we couldn't imagine where we were going to get this cake. So she was just basically taking her in from one shop to another. Hey, look who my son knows. She then called another couple who she never got along with because they were always bragging about their son's success. She invited them over, and they brought a cake, okay? And they invited them over just basically to show off, okay? I felt real guilty about this, and I kept on saying, gee, I owe you. I'm sorry I've subjected you to this, da-da-da-da. And she was real sweet. And I knew that she would get back at me somehow. About a week or so later, at Studio 54, there was this huge party, which they threw for Gilda and the other cast members. And I'm walking around, and, you know, look, this is 1976, and there's strobe lights, and, you know, there's real blaring music, and you know, and it was just, you know, it was Studio 54, whatever that was. And I'm looking in a corner of the room, and I'm going, no, that can't be. And I figured it was the strobes that was distorting the image, and I walk closer, and I walk closer. And in fact, I do see my mother dancing with Halston and my father trying to look down Bianca Jagger's dress. You know, she was like seated, and my father was like walking around with a drink in his hand. And I'm going, how the hell did this happen? Who invited them? And I sought Gilda out, and I said, what did you do here? What is this? You did this, didn't you? And that was her way of getting back at me, you know, for going to the, you know, the mall with for a cake that had no bakery and all of that. She invited them to this party, unbeknownst to me, and was really a shock. But what was even more shocking about it was also at the party, she invited that same couple who my mother had come over with the cake, you know, they were at the party. She invited High and Rhoda Rappaport to the party. And next to them on the bar was a cake box. She had this couple bring a cake to Studio 54. And what the hell? How do you, that's amazing to me.
No, your book is subtitled A Sort of Love Story. And let me explain where I think the sort of comes in. I mean, you loved each other as friends, but it sounds like you really wanted to love each other as lovers. But she kept saying that you shouldn't let the girl thing and the boy thing come, the girl-boy thing come between you. She was really afraid that your relationship could be ruined if you became more intimate. So was that hard for you?
Yeah, it was difficult at first, but it was logical as well, only because it was a time of changes for two people who met on a show like this, who were going through the changes of success and, in her case, fame, and then the ups and downs of whatever anybody's lives are like over a 15-year period of time. The hope was that we would sustain and be there for each other, and it was logically decided that we would try our best to just keep it creative and friendly.
How did Gilda break the news to you that she was sick?
For months, I was told by her that she had Epstein-Barr virus.
That's a virus that leaves you feeling exhausted all the time.
It's like mono in a way, I guess. And, you know, people would you'd run this real low-grade temperature and there were stretches of time where you're just tired and you'd sleep forever and all of that. And about a month or so later, we were on the phone and she had mentioned that she heard from the doctors and she didn't have Epstein-Barr virus. And I thought, oh, wow, this is great. We could we can play. We can go out and have fun because she won't be sleeping all the time anymore having those symptoms. And I said, oh, wow, that's terrific. And she said, I have cancer. And I said, what? And she said, I have ovarian cancer and I need you to get me through this part of my life. And I said, sure. What should I do? And she said, just make me laugh. And we started that part.
Was that hard to do, to be funny when she was so sick?
Well, yeah. You know, you're with somebody who is has this horrible disease and it's got a horrible name. And you know how it usually ends. And you want to ask them how they are. You don't know how to act. You know, you don't know what to say, but it seems like you should be talking about it. But she was a different kind of a spirit. All she really cared about was life and hope and positive stuff. So on one hand, your heart went out, but on the other hand, you knew that the best thing you could do as a friend was to stress the positive and just keep that part going.
My guest is Alan Zweibel. His new book, Bunny Bunny, is about his friendship and collaboration with Gilda Radner. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comedy writer Alan Zweibel. Gilda Radner was the first person you wrote for who you were writing for a character, not just telling jokes. I'm interested in some of the jokes that you wrote back when you were writing for the comics who were in the Borscht Belt, in the Catskill Mountains. You said you wrote for Toadie Fields, for Rodney Dangerfield. What kind of material were you doing for them? Well, remember any of the jokes?
Well, I see. First of all, I must tell you that I had to graduate to that level. When I first started...
Oh, it was the unknowns first.
Oh, you know something? Every Morty, every Lee, every Freddie that ever lived, I wrote for, okay? I was 22 years old. I was just out of college. In college, I started sending jokes to Dick Cavett and Johnny Carson and Mad Magazine, you know, to get started. And So my mom and dad went to Lake Tahoe, and they saw Engelbert Humperdinck. This is the summer of 1972 or 72. And on the bill was a comedian named Morty Gunty, who was this Catskill comedian. And my mom saw him in a coffee shop the next day, mentioned me to him. And I started writing for him and some of these other Catskill guys. They were twice as old as I was. So I was basically wanting to write jokes about, you know, having sex or marijuana or whatever political left thing I was into at the time. And these guys wanted jokes about paving the driveway, you know.
The kids today.
These nutty kids, you know. And I'm going, wow. So I would write jokes for them for $7 a joke. And what was great about it was I would send them the McDonald's routine. I would send them the joke about the Hasidic porno movie where the orgy scene had the men on one side and the women on the other. I would do those jokes about my grandfather having an electronic pacemaker in his heart, which worked great, except every time he sneezed, the garage door went up. I sent them all of that stuff. And then the fun part would happen because I'd get in my parents' car and I'd go up to the Raleigh Hotel or the Concord. And some of the guys would just give me $7 if they accepted the jokes. Many of them would only give me the $7 if the joke got a laugh. Well, that's when the fun really began, because I'm sitting in the audience. I clearly heard a laugh. And they're on stage, and afterwards they go, "Nat bombed." I'm going, "What are you talking about? What constitutes a laugh with you?" And then what happened was many of the jokes they wouldn't buy because it wasn't for their audience.
You know, a lot of the comics today have personas. They do their act in persona, mm-hmm. like Gilbert Gottfried. And, you know, they have a certain kind of voice they use on stage and a certain character that they do.
Sure.
There were a lot of comics who didn't have personas when you started writing, but they had shticks. You know, like Bob Newhart's thing was that he was always talking on the phone to
right.
somebody. Larry Best did a thing where he was pretending he was eating an apple.
Sure.
Yeah. So did you have to write for people who had a shtick?
Oh, yeah, prior to Saturday Night?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there was a guy named Jerry Shane who did a thing with a rope.
A thing with a rope?
Yeah, I don't remember. That was his. I didn't write that for him, but I remember when I did speak with him a few times, if you can hit more stuff for the rope trick stuff. So I was going to write rope tricks. There was weird people like that. There was stuff that didn't pan out. You know, stuff like the apple that Larry Best did. My God, he did that his whole life. That was the one thing that he did, you know. And people were always looking for that kind of hook. People like Rodney Dangerfield would have, you know, "I don't get no respect." So comedians would say, "Can you create a hook for me? Can you create some sort of a moniker that people would know me by?"
Did you make up any?
Well, yeah, I tried to. There was one comic where he wanted me. He talked about he lost his wallet. And he called me on the phone. He says, "You know, I lost my wallet." I went, "Yeah." He says, "And you know what kind of big pain in the neck it is to replace your driver's license and this credit card and that credit card?" I went, "Yeah." He says, "Do you think that could be my hook?" I said, "Let me see if I understand this correctly. You want to be the comic who lost his wallet?" And yeah, he wanted to be the wallet-losing comic, you know. And just like Shanley has on his current show, he's got the Jeffrey Tambor character going, "Hey now," you know, just the way Ed
yeah.
McMahon... The guys would say, "Just send me a list of phrases," and maybe one of them would be, you know, "brown shoes." It would be about anything. You just write any three or four words that you wanted. "Hey, I'm over my cold." And they would expect like an applause from that. You know what I mean? You know?
It sounds depressing in a way that there'd be people who were desperate to be comics, and yet they couldn't even come up with what their own personality on stage would be.
I had an experience which was fairly interesting. I had written for a comic in 1973, and I wrote some routines for him and some what were then topical jokes. About 10 years later, either 83, 84, thereabouts, we went up to Catskill Mountain. I guess it was like a winter weekend. We took the kids skiing or something, and there was a show. There was a show there, and the comedian on the bill was one of these guys that I had written for. So we went to the show. And I saw and heard a lot of the jokes that I had written 10 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, we met the comedian at the bar, and he said, "You see, your jokes, they're still getting laughs." I said, "Yeah, that's great." He says, any suggestions? You have anything, any ideas about anything? I said, well, now that you ask, what you might want to consider is that joke that I wrote for you 10 years ago about the Secretary of State. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
Yeah. I said, it might work in your behalf if you take out Kissinger's name and maybe replace it with George Shultz or Cyrus, whoever it was at the time. He's looking at me. I said, you know, that would make it more topical because Kissinger's not the Secretary of State anymore, unless you maybe want to put it in the past tense. But you got to do one of those things. And he says, yeah. He says, if I'm talking about that guy today, I'll use... He writes down the Secretary of State's name on a cocktail napkin. He says, I'll tell you how it works out. And it was funny, but it's staggering that somebody who you would think does this, has a craft, that this is logical almost, you know? But there's a lot of that.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, this was great.
Alan Zweibel's new memoir about his friendship with Gilda Radner is called Bunny Bunny. This is Fresh Air.